Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Our guest this week is Jude Treswell, and normally right now I would go straight to Justine, but I have an announcement to make that I don't think even Justine knows about.
Nope, I'm waiting for the surprise.
We're now on Patreon.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, we now have a Patreon account. So if our listeners enjoy learning about LGBTQ crime novels and authors and would like to help support this show, they just need to go to patreon.com/gaymysterypodcast. And what they'll get is a shout out on the show.
Yeah.
And depending on the level, they may get early access to the show and a shout out of their favorite author or book.
So sounds great.
It's patreon.com/gaymysterypodcast, and you'll help defray the cost of this podcast. So just had to get that out there.
Sounds great.
Pimping for money.
Pimping for money. You know, podcasts and equipment cost more than people would be interested in knowing, and hosting and those sorts of things.
Yes, hosting is the key. So you've got, I'm sure, a book to review for us this week.
We do. I am slipping from the gay mystery category of the Lambda Awards over to the lesbian mystery category of the Lambda Awards.
Okay.
So this year, the second book in the Janet Watson Chronicles, The Hound of Justice by Claire O'Dell, is a finalist for the lesbian mystery category. And her first book in the series was A Study in Honor. And this book is a continuation of the series. So if you don't want to be spoiled for the first book, then don't start here. Start at the first book. But you don't need the first book to understand this one. And I don't know what your preference is on these things, Brad. I know that you prefer books to be standalones, or you want to start with the first in the series. I can't ever tell, though, if a book works as a standalone and it gives away the earlier mystery, how you feel about that one.
I'm still okay with that.
Okay.
As long as it's a standalone.
Yeah.
As long as I can start anywhere, I can always go back and start at the beginning, which is always the most fun. But I can read, as long as I can pick up a book and it makes sense.
Yeah, there's a little bit of heavy lifting at the other one, because you're thrown into a different world. What happened is, this is sci-fi, a little sci-fi. It's in the future. And there was this discord that started at the end of the Trump administration. I'm not quite sure how far in the future this book was. I have a feeling that some of that groundwork was laid in the first book. But in this one, you get the sense of it's been a while. And now there's the new Civil War. And we have the federal states run by a new president, and the new Confederacy, which was a splinter, seceded from the nation. And there's terrorists. Book starts on inauguration of the new president, and it's called Bloody Inauguration Day. And terrorists from the new Confederacy have blown up, set bombs across the country. So Janet Watson, who is the star of this book, is a surgeon. She lost an arm in the first book. And at the beginning of this book, she is learning her new bionic arm. And the technology of the arm is more advanced than anything we have now. Her roommate is Sarah Holmes. And even though their names are Holmes and Watson, do not expect a Holmes and Watson style mystery. Her roommate, Sarah Holmes, is part of the CIA, and she's got various implants in her body. So that puts it in a slightly futuristic thing. So it's a bit of fantasy with the new Civil War, and also a bit of sci-fi with these extra bionic parts to both the characters.
Now, the Civil War part scares me, because that seems very doable, the way things are going.
Well, you know, it is very doable, and there's not enough of the, it's not so much the facts that of the politics today, but enough of the feeling of what goes on now to make it believable. and there's a fair amount of politics. I really would categorize this as a political thriller. And okay, you know, the Lambda doesn't have a political thriller kind of category. So the mystery category encompasses things like suspense and thriller books.
And we do suspense and thriller too.
We do suspense and thriller too. But even though it's in the mystery category, this is really more of a political thriller. There's no crime at the beginning. There's a plot and evildoers, and the good guys are out to get the evildoers. They need a surgeon in the Confederacy. They have to smuggle Janet Watson down. And most of the book is her getting the seeds, learning what's the limits of her bionic armor, the bombing, and then there's weird stuff going in the hospital, and then the journey to go and carry out this Black Ops mission. And it's a fun book. I really enjoy it.
It sounds thrilling.
It does sound thrilling. I enjoyed it quite a bit. The Holmes and Watson had put me in the mind for a traditional mystery. And once I got the idea that it wasn't going to be a traditional mystery and kind of reset my expectations, it met those expectations and far exceeded them. Oh. So I think our readers will like it. It gets a thrilling recommendation. Also, it's a glowing recommendation.
Thrilling and glowing.
Yeah. Glowing usually means that it's very well written, and this one is particularly well written.
Wow. High accolades for this one.
Yeah.
And again, it's The Hounds of Justice.
Hounds of Justice. It's a finalist in the lesbian mystery category. And the first book, A Study in Honor, won the lesbian mystery category last year.
And
so
by,
this is a award-winning author.
And it's Claire O'Dell?
Claire O'Dell.
Good deal.
And, you know, Requeer Tales has republished the first of the Nikki Baker series, the Virginia Kelly Mysteries. And that Nikki Baker was the first Black lesbian mystery novelist. And so we're republishing that three book series. And the first one is already out. It's available on Kindle Unlimited. It's called In the Game by Nikki Baker. And if this is a genre that you like, if you're looking particularly for stories about women of color and in the mystery genre, that works. And this is a political thriller with the same sort of issues of race.
And I know I say I'm going to read these books, but that one actually is very high on my list.
Yeah. I know you don't have enough time to read all the books that are on your list of books.
No. But this one's
so
high.
So we're
up
always
there.
Pleased when a book at least gets to your list.
This one's high.
Good. Good. And also tomorrow, Recruit Tales is bringing out Mask for a Deaver, which is the fourth of the Grant Michael series, Stan Krachik. And all four of those books are available in Kindle Unlimited. And this is a 7-book series, and we have our hands on an unpublished 8th book manuscript, and we're hoping to get that into a shape to release sometime in the late 2021. That's a very popular series. That is our bestseller.
Grant Michaels, and what was the name of the book?
Mask for a Diva.
Mask for a Diva. All right. Anything else from Recruit Tales?
No, that's all we have. We have a lot of books, so if you want to search Recruit Tales on Amazon, you'll see our full catalog that's out now, or at our website, recruittales.com.
Well, I've got Jude Treadwell coming up, so sit back and relax and enjoy the interview.
I'm looking forward to it, as always.
Okay,
see you next week, Brad.
Okay, I'll see you then, Justine. If you enjoy hearing from LGBTQ crime fiction writers and would like to support this podcast, go to www.patreon.com/gaymysterypodcast. My guest is Jude Treadwell. Jude's stories are set in County Durham, Northeast England. They feature a gay polyamorous quad who solve crimes, are victims of crimes, and who sometimes commit crimes. A fifth tale, A Share in a Secret, will be published later this year. Jude lives with her husband in Southeast England. She misses the sounds and scenery of her native north. Welcome, Jude.
Thank you, Brad.
It's a pleasure to have you on today.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to do it. As I said, I'm really excited about it.
Oh, good. You seem excited.
Yeah.
Let's get going. I'm going to throw a hard one at you right at the beginning.
Oh, great. Thanks.
And it's one you already know. I'm going to start by admitting I was nervous about presenting a book about four men in a polyamorous relationship. As you know, we talked about it. And the reason is I didn't see how you would have time to devote that much to the relationship and the crime. And as you know, on this show, crime is prime.
Crime is prime.
Yes, crime is prime. But after reading your reviews and part of the book, I realized that you did a good job of balancing the two.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Not an easy task. So I have to ask you, what possessed an asexual married mother with grown children to write about four gay men in a polyamorous relationship?
Right. Good question, isn't it? Yeah. Well,
told you I was going to hit a hard ball.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's one I thought you might ask me. So I'll try and do my best here. About 4 years ago, I saw a BBC video clip of a gay, polyamorous, Colombian quad. I'm going to get the pronunciations of their names wrong because I don't speak Spanish, but they were Alejandro, Victor, Manuel, and Alex. And Alex had died, and the other three were talking. And I was so taken by so many things about these guys. I thought it was really, really sweet. I thought they were really sweet. I thought that they were showing so much affection to each other. And I thought they were so supportive of each other. And the whole situation got to me. And I kept thinking about it. Long after I'd seen the video, I was still thinking about this. And as you said, you know, I'm a monogamous lady. And I'd never even thought of polyamory. And it made me look at polyamory and think about it. And I started thinking, you know, there have been times in my married life when it might have been quite good to have somebody else around, which doesn't mean what it might sound like. But there are times when it would be handy to have somebody else to share things with, not just the one person. And I put that on one side. I kept thinking about these guys and polyamory, and I did quite a lot of reading about polyamory. But I also had a book that I'd already written, a fan fiction. Can I go on to talk about that? Because it's putting the two things together. You okay with that, Brad?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. Well, I'd written a fan fiction, which I had no intention of putting onto AO3 because it was in no way transformative. It was actually finishing a story that I felt an author had left unfinished. And that author was the British crime writer, Reginald Hill. And when I used to read his books, it was a series called D. Alan Pascoe. I always enjoyed reading about one of the secondary characters who was a gay bike-riding sergeant called Edgar Weald. And I always felt that Weald's story was unfinished. So I, for my own eyes only, I finished it. But I just had a 60,000-word story about this guy. And I don't know why or how, but somehow that story and the idea of the polyamorous guys got conflated. And I thought, okay, rewrite the story, but give it a polyamorous flavor. So what I wrote was Badge of Loyalty, which was book one of the County Durham Quad series. And it was my plot completely. It's nothing to do with the four Colombian guys other than the polyamory flavor. Mm-hmm. And the characters are nothing to do with the Reginald Hill characters that were the original inspiration, because I was very aware that characters are copyright for 70 years. I didn't want to get into any trouble. So I turned the whole thing on its head. And that's how Badger Loyalty got written. So it was a composite of finding out about these guys who live in Colombia and writing a fan fiction and putting the two together, but making it my own thing, basically.
Well, and I think a lot of us get our inspiration from other novels. There's a big difference between getting inspiration and copying.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and it's impossible for us to know sometimes where our ideas come from. Yeah. And it could have come from a novel or a movie or someone we know. And
You don't even know it, do you?
Sometimes. No. So how can you avoid it? You know.
Yeah.
But
I knew what I was doing here, so I made a point of making it very different. If that makes sense.
Yes, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And fan fiction is the way a lot of writers get started. And I think it's you know, you kept it to yourself, and that's great. You were able to get your writing chops in, and look where you are now. Four novels.
Cool.
Yeah. Or do you have more than four?
I've got four full-length novels out. I've got a short story out, and I've got the fifth one, A Share in a Secret. It's just being finalized now.
Well, let's get to the mystery. Obviously, you can only say so much, which makes part of my job hard. But what can you tell us about the novels?
Every one of them starts off with a crime. Which doesn't mean it's the first thing that happens in the plot, because it often isn't the first thing that happens in the plot. Mm-hmm. But it's always a crime that gives me the idea for the stories, apart from that first one. That first one had a different reason for being, so it's slightly different from the other books. But all the others have been some kind of crime that's been on the television or on the radio or in the news, something, and it stayed in my head. And I've wanted to make a story out of it. So, for example, Polyamory on Trial, which was the second book, all the time I was seeing these awful scenes of people trying to seek asylum, coming across the Mediterranean and getting drowned, you know, coming from Arabia and Libya and Syria and places. And the whole idea of asylum seeking was in my head, and the whole idea that people are trafficked when they do that very often. They don't end up in a better life. They end up sometimes in an equally bad one. And that was so much on my mind. So the crime in Polyamory on Trial was trafficking. When that was the main crime. But the stories don't start off with a crime in the sense that I wouldn't say that they're classic whodunits that go from A to B. The crime often crops up partway through the story. What was the next one? Ace in the Picture. That was a forgery. Worked around a forged painting, and I'd read something about a forger who was just forging paintings in his shed, and I thought that was very interesting, and it led me on to the whole idea of the forgery, and the forgery came into Ace in the Picture. And then we had Body Parts and Mind Games, and again it was the news I was reading about the awful things that are happening to, say, the Falun Gong and people who are perhaps being imprisoned for political reasons and then suffering the taking of body parts even when they don't want to, you know, all that sort of things. And that found its way into my head and into the stories. So it's always some kind of crime that's going on in life, and that sets the thought process is off, if you like.
So basically it's the news and real stories that inspire you for your plots.
It is, but then I kind of leave them behind. But they're definitely what starts it. And the one that I've just sort of more or less finished, Sharing a Secret, last year, for example, it's all gone pot at the moment because obviously it's schools in the UK have been stopped because of COVID-19, but last year the government decided to bring in a new curriculum. It would have become statutory this year, and it involves teaching children about relationships. It's relationships, health and sex, and it's about inclusivity. But when it was tried at a primary school in the Midlands, primary school for us is 5-year-olds to 11-year-olds, the homophobic response was just horrendous. And that, again, that is something that got into my head. And that started me off on a share in a secret. So the crime is always a crime, but then that crime is sort of left behind as other things take over, as the four guys get usually into a mess.
And can each of these be read as a standalone?
Yes, I think I sort of think of them as somewhere between a series and a serial. Mm-hmm. That they're not a serial because there's gaps between. But obviously, when you're writing about the same characters over and over again, it helps to know the background.
Yes.
But I think that from what I've read from when people have reviewed them, most people seem to reckon that you could come in on any of them and get the idea of the story. I do try to put some background in, but I've got to be careful. I don't want to just repeat what I've written before.
Of course.
So it's a compromise. I feel that they could be read as standalones, though I also feel that probably you'd get more out of them if you had at least read one of the others.
Yeah, I think that's true of, I can't think of the mystery writer. She was so prolific. She wrote the Alphabet series. But anyway, all of her books are standalone, but it's always more fun to start at the beginning and read through. So each one is a standalone. You can pick one up and enjoy it. But yeah, it's always more fun to start at the beginning.
And so, sometimes it's good to, you maybe read book four or five or something, and then you actually then go back and you think, oh, now I understand. Now I can see something. So there's different ways of going about it.
That's true. And as far as you were saying that your books, sometimes the crime doesn't start right away. I'm actually reading, or actually just recently read a novel that's highly rated, and it was beautifully written. And the crime didn't start till about a third of the way through the novel.
So
you know, as long as the story is a good story and can carry it, and then you end up with a great mystery, it doesn't have to be page one.
So
you talked about Reginald Hill. Do you want to talk about a little more about him as far as how he influenced you to become a writer, mystery writer?
It hasn't influenced my way of writing at all. It was just that he had this secondary character called Edgar Weald. And I found that I was far more interested in Wieldy than I was in D. Alan Pascoe, the main characters. And Reginald Hill was very clever about the way he dealt with Weald. He starts off as a sad character, but there are little bits in several of the books and he gets built up gradually. And sometimes he has a big part, sometimes he has a very tiny part. But I just felt that there were times when one of the other characters would say to Wieldy, hey, Wieldy, if you had to choose between your new boyfriend and your job, which would you choose? And I always felt that if Reginald Hill had lived a bit longer, he might have written a story where he brought that in. But of course, in 2012, sadly, he died. So that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to finish Wieldy's story, which is what I did for myself.
So that's what you've led you to write.
Yeah,
that.
That's what I did. So I took the bare bones of that, which was choosing between the person that you love and the job that you do, professionalism against personal interest, and that's what became Badge of Loyalty.
Now, the themes of your book can get pretty heavy. You have brutal murders, rape, human trafficking. How are you able to write these situations yet keep from exploiting them?
Exploiting them, maybe.
It's not easy to do.
Oh, gosh. No, I would like to think that I did manage to do that. I think I do manage to do that. I'm thinking of some of the reviews now where people have said that I've dealt with these issues sensitively. Because these issues upset me, I suppose.
Good answer. But I know another question I have is, it's a challenge for any author to write from multiple points of view. And you're able to write dialogue for four characters. Mm-hmm. Now, it would grow tiresome to read, Mike said this, and Ross said Absolutely. This, and Phil said this. How were you able to overcome that?
Actually, five characters, because from book three onwards, I've also got Nick Seabrook there.
Oh, even worse.
Yeah, so there's often five characters. He's not one of the quad, but he's there. Different ways. Firstly, I love writing dialogue. I really enjoy dialogue. I like to hear speech. Mm-hmm. So I've got different ways I try to deal with that. Sometimes I can deal with it because of the people's characters. They speak differently because their characters are different. So, for example, Mike. And Mike's probably the glue in all this. He's the one it all happens around usually. Mike is very blunt. And he swears a heck of a lot. And I can make his speech echo his bluntness. He also has quite a strong accent. For example, he wouldn't say writing. He'd say writing. He never puts a G at the end of anything. That is mm-hmm. a typical accent of his locality. So when I write Mike, I always make sure that there's at least one word in his bit of speech that doesn't have a G in it. So it's kind of clear that Mike is speaking. I don't need always to put Mike said at the end of it. Mm-hmm. Wraith, his character also, I can make his character show through what he says. For example, Wraith can be very literal. So in the story I've just been writing, I'm just thinking of an example here. Somebody says to Wraith, oh, I don't know what to say. You know, when you're shocked and you're surprised and you say, oh, I don't know what to say. And Wraith says, oh, well, what you should say is, in other words, he takes this very, very literally. So that's one thing he often does, and I can bring that out in what he says. He's also what Mike calls a lateral non-thinker. He's here, there, and everywhere with what he says. He starts off with one thing, he goes on to something else, and he finishes off with a third thing. So his speech I can deal with like that. So I think Wraith, even if I didn't say on the end, Wraith said, he is quite clear to write because of the person that he is. Phil,
that takes a lot of skill to do that.
Ooh, well.
And a lot of thought.
Well, I don't think I'm very skillful, but I enjoy doing it. I enjoy writing the speech that goes with their characters. But Ross and Phil, I can't do that with them because socially and educationally, they're very similar, those two. Their backgrounds are similar, and I think that their speech patterns would probably be very similar. And also, you know, when you live with people and you've lived with them a while, you tend to pick up their speech patterns anyway, don't you? You pick up mm-hmm. little things, and you end up all sounding the same in a way anyway. So those two are very, very difficult to show who's speaking through the content of what they say. So what I tend to do there is, and it's something, oh, now was it Mark McNeice? I'm not sure. Somebody you interviewed some weeks ago talked about the illusion of speech. And I can't think who it was. I'm sorry to that person. Okay. But it is the illusion of speech, because if you really had four or five people sitting by each other across a table, they'd get each other's attention by looking at each other. You know, they'd say something, oh, what do you think? And they'd look at that person. Mm-hmm. So what I do, the illusion of speech, is somebody might say something, and then the next person says, oh, I don't know about that, Ross, or, oh, I never thought of that, Wraith. So the second bit of speech refers back to the first bit of speech that doesn't have a Ross said, a Phil said. Does that make sense? I think I write more clearly than I speak, Brad.
No, it makes perfect sense. It's very clear to me how you do that.
That happens a lot, you know. So there's a reference back to the previous speaker, and that gets around the Ross said, Mike said, etc.
Gotcha. Well, you are a fan of this show, so I think you know what time it is.
Oh, you're going to spin that wheel, aren't you?
I am going to spin the wheel, and you're going to get one of the awkward questions that authors get. So hold on tight here while I spin the wheel. Okay, you get one of the fun ones.
Oh, do I?
Are you as socially inept as all writers?
Yes. Can't you tell? it must be pretty obvious from this interview. Yes, I am.
Well, I wouldn't say that you sound all that inept, but I... And I don't know that all authors are inept, but
no, I was just going to say that actually. I don't know about the all. If you said that, am I socially inept? I'd say yes, but I don't know about the all authors.
Hey, stereotypes exist for a reason.
Pardon?
Stereotypes do exist for a reason.
Oh, yes.
I want to talk about your book covers and your characters.
Okay.
Your book covers are interesting in that your characters are all silhouettes.
Always.
And like some other authors, you've chosen not to go in depth in describing their physical detail.
That's right.
What was your motivation for doing that?
I can't do it. It's as simple as that. I have no idea what my men look like. The only one of them that I really describe is Wraith. And the reason, he's outrageous. He's an artist. He's a ceramicist. He's just a total one-off. And his physical being is part of that. So I do describe, for example, the fact that he's got long dark hair, that he puts ribbons and bows and heaven knows what else in, because that's part of his character. But the others, I don't even know what he looks like really, but I've got no idea what they look like. I have a big difficulty in visualizing anything like that. And that goes for the scenery as well. I mean, the scenery, the area is crucial to me. I know exactly where all this is happening. I know the part of County Durham where it's happening, but I never describe it because I can't. Cannot do. It's a total shortcoming. So I've got no idea what the men look like, and that's one of the reasons why I always have silhouettes.
Now,
Do
you think that may be by choice without you realizing that?
No, I think it's something that I'm not good at. It's really hard for me to... I don't think that I ever practiced writing descriptions. When I read books myself, I tend to gloss over any kind of description. So I don't think that I've ever learned to do it. I've never been to a writing group. I've never taken a course in writing. So I think that basically I don't know how to do description. I think that's what it is. But I don't see these things in my head at all. I just don't see them. Also, as regards to silhouettes, there was another reason why I chose silhouettes for the covers. I know the books could be construed as being MM, and I didn't want sassy men on the front of the covers because to me, the books are not just about relationships, they're about the crime, the mystery, it's the whole thing. And I didn't want the covers to give the idea that the stories were about sassy men, though they are sassy men.
So you didn't want four sexy shirtless men on the cover?
That's exactly what I didn't want. But the real reason is because I just can't see them. I've got no idea what they look like. You know. Well, Mike's got grey-green eyes. But again, that's relevant to the stories. But no, I don't visualize things. I like dialogue. I hear things, but I don't see things at all.
Well, and that, to me, that's okay. I like a little bit of a description, but I don't like a deep description, because I like to create the character myself. I base my characters on pictures that I find online, but I don't go into detail of what they look like, and nor would I ever show a person a picture of them, because I want that person to make their own decision. That's why I'm not going to say I never would, but I can't imagine ever putting a person on the cover of my book.
No,
I want the reader to understand what that person looks like. Not my vision.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I've read your body your body one.
Body in the bathhouse.
Body in the bathhouse. Yeah, senior moment there. Forgive me. And you did some great descriptions, but with every apology in my head, I can't get through to descriptions. I just can't do it. I can't do it. So I don't do it.
Well, you told me earlier when we did the sound check early in the week that you love your characters. But I have to ask you, would you hang out with them?
No, they drop me around the twist. I mean, if I lived with them, there'd be four more crimes, and it'd be me who'd commit them. I'm not joking. I'd strangle the four of them. I mean, Phil, he's a lovely guy. He's a doctor. He's so caring. He's kind. He's fun. He's a lovely guy. But he worries about everything. Well, I'm a worrier. So me and Phil together, that would be just terrible. You know, we'd spend the day worrying. So I couldn't have Phil. I couldn't have Mike. I mean, Mike's the proactive one. He's a biker. He's aggressive. He's forceful. But he's so intense, and he's intense about everything. He's loyal to a fault. He'd just be too much. He'd be too difficult for me. Ross, he's seems to be the very well-adjusted one. He's business savvy. He's sharp. He's the one who oils all the quad's wheels. But there's a bit of Rossi that's underhand, and I wouldn't like that. No, I'd be a bit suspect of Ross. And as regards Wraith, well, he's just so high maintenance. He's up, he's down, he's all over the place. I couldn't take probably an hour of Wraith would be enough.
It sounds like your dialogue, we were talking about how you're able to separate the characters. They certainly sound like they each have very distinct characteristics about them as well.
They do, but as the thing is that they are very different. Mm-hmm. But as a group, they work as a group. Their strength is the fact that they work together. They would do anything for each other. They are very supportive of each other. And although they might have big issues and big faults as individuals, as a group, there's no stopping them. They're good.
I think that's true of a lot of couples, or a lot of relationships, I should say.
Yeah. 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 I depend very heavily on my husband for a lot of things. Yeah. Yeah.
And my husband and I are very different in a lot of ways. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what? Yeah. Speaking of your husband, what do your friends and family think of your writing?
Well, my husband does read the books through and makes the occasional comment about where I've put full stops and things like that. My daughter actually has done the covers for the last book and for the short story that I wrote, and I love that cover that she did for the short story. And she's doing the cover for the current one, but she doesn't enjoy the books. No, I'm kind of quiet about what I do, and I don't actually talk about them much with friends. I mean, some of my friends know I write the books, but they've never read my books. I've never asked them to read the books.
Well, Jude, I've got to tell you, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today. This has been very interesting.
Oh gosh, I've enjoyed doing it. You're right. It goes so quickly.
Yes, I told you it would go fast.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Oh, can I say one other thing then?
Oh, you certainly may.
I've put, this might go out on the 16th, mightn't it? From the 16th to the 20th, my last one, The Body Parts and Mind Games, is on Amazon Kindle free. And then 21st to the 25th, the short story is on free as well. So, you know, that might just, if people are interested.
Yep, and for those that may be listening in the future, we're talking about April of 2020.
We are.
So we're talking about the 16th of April, you said?
Yeah.
And then what was the other date?
21st to the 25th, which is the short story. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
This is a good time to have people having free stories. People have a lot of time on their hands.
Absolutely. Well, you said yourself, didn't you? You said that you'd actually put one of yours, The Body in the Bathhouse, was...
I did run it free for a short time, yes.
Yeah. Yep. It's, as you say, it's a time when people are stuck in, sadly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, again, it's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. Oh, no, thank you. Okay.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.